The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salner & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salner, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Hello, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition, for this particular week. And we're getting back to kind of a new topic area after we spent a bunch of time on the EDU show talking about our fund number concept. But now we're going to swing back to more general retirement and IRA issues. And we're going to tackle that via a little bit of help from the Ed Slot Group, who does a variety of things. But one thing they do is provide Jim with lots of interesting questions and answers to these retirement and IRA questions. And he's going to share some of those. He goes a couple times a year to visit with Ed. I'm sure he's probably on a first-name basis with him at this point, as part of the Ed Slot's training program for financial advisors and planners. And as usual, he's come back with a treasure trove of info, particularly because we're dealing in a Secure Act 2.0 world. So lots of stuff changes. Congress does us a favor and offers punishment all in the same stroke of the pen whenever they up and alter the way some of the retirement things work, particularly taxes related to retirement accounts and retirement planning. But Ed Slot does a great job of allowing us to, you know, use information to share with you all about these topics. So I'll bring Jim in. Jim is still, he's on the tail end of his journey down to Florida, and we'll be heading back to the warm Colorado that had kind of a weird miniature version of an ice storm this morning, actually. We don't get ice storms here much. That's more of a humid back east kind of a phenomenon. I don't envy you all that have to put up with this on a regular basis, especially when it gets coated on there half an inch thick on your car. We had a miniature version of that today. Just had the perfect environment for ice on everything as we woke up and tried to start our day. So Jim can look forward to that as he comes back from balmy Florida and sitting by the pool and drinking pina coladas and whatever he's been doing down there.
Well, apparently you are misunderstanding. I got in last night. I woke up to the sheet of ice as well.
I thought you were still a couple more days.
No.
Well, there you go. He's back. How'd you like the ice storm? Welcome back.
came back to, I really wouldn't categorize it as a deep ice storm, but it was enough that I woke up in the morning and said, screw it, I'm not driving to the office. So I used that as an excuse to stay in my warm bed. But no, I am back. I got in last night from sunny Florida, sunny, hot Florida. My goodness, they are having a heat wave, and they also had some red tide in the Venice Beach area. And it was, I went to the beach on Saturday. I had to leave after a little over an hour. It was just unbearable. Your eyes are watering. I kept coughing. And it wasn't just me. A lot of people on the beach were coughing and sneezing. And I wasn't putting two and two together until, as I was leaving, a woman was walking by and she sneezed. And I said to her, God bless you. I says, I have had allergies or something all of a sudden. I said, I've been in Florida for 2 weeks and it hasn't bothered me until today. And she's the one who told me that it was the red tide. And she showed me this big warning sign that I had walked by and didn't even see about the red tide and to be careful. And oh, I was miserable. So anyways, I am back and anxious to get back into the swing of things after being gone for a couple of weeks, even though it was what I call a workcation, where I was kind of doing work, even though it wasn't as deep a work as I do when I'm in Colorado. I never really had a day off. And then, of course, I spent 3 days with Jacob doing some software training on a program that we're thinking of adding. So Jacob flew out to Orlando and I drove to Orlando and met him. One thing I can say, Chris, about Florida traffic, it stinks. It's horrendous. Probably not California bad because I've driven in California, but it is not pleasurable. Let me just say, you wait everywhere with traffic. So I think it's all the people that are moving to Florida. It's just unbearable. Orlando, of course, being with all the theme parks there, the traffic there wasn't very fun. And the highway traffic with all the construction, it just was not very nice if you had to drive.
I guess that's a good reason to spend a lot of time at the beach.
Yes, but you have to drive to get to said beach. Unless you're staying in a hotel right on the beach or you own one of those condos right on the beach. But it wasn't fun driving, that I'll have to say. But anyways, it is what it is. It was a good time. My next travels, in case people are wondering, I will be going to Washington, D.C. for our spring Ed Slot training the end of April. So while I'm in Washington, I figure since I've already flown cross country, after that, I will fly back up to Massachusetts, spend a little bit of time there, about 4 or 5 days, before flying to Kansas City, where I will do the estate planning council training that I started doing over the past few years. As longtime listeners know, I'm geeking out on estate planning for some reason. And I just kind of enjoy going and hanging out with a bunch of estate planning attorneys and learning about estate planning topics. So I'll be doing that again. And that's the first weekend in May. So the timing just works out perfect, Chris. I'll fly to Washington, fly home, fly to Kansas City, and then fly back to Colorado. So that'll be my next travels towards the end of April, beginning of May. So I am kind of looking forward to that again. Other than that, that's all that's going on with me. Okay. Nice. So today's show, folks, is going to be, for years I've been thinking about taking the quote-unquote tests that the Ed Slot group gives us, reading the questions, providing the answers, letting you all guess the answers as well, because it's a multiple choice questions he gives us, and then opining a little bit on the answers. And I thought it's time we bring the IRA back to the Retirement and IRA show. We spent so many shows talking a lot about the retirement side, especially when we did a whole series on the fund number and briefly touched upon our minimum dignity floor concept again and the need for secure income. And then that bled over into the Q&A show where we answered a series of questions dedicated solely to that. I just got the idea when I recently took this exam to go ahead and start going through the exam and turn it into a series of EDU podcasts. I think it'll be pretty fun. I think a lot of our listeners will enjoy the myriad of topics that they cover on the exam. But a little bit about the exam so you understand what the Ed Slot group is and isn't. The Ed Slot group is not any type of certification program. It's not a sanctioned program through any university. It doesn't give us any particular level of professionalism. What it simply is a dedicated group. He's got about 400 people now in his program, give or take 20 or 30. Sometimes he has 410 or 20, and other times he has 370 or 80. It kind of varies back and forth. But we pretty much pay him a fee on an annual basis, and he gives us access to himself and to some of what he calls his consultants. And they help us understand IRA and planning concepts and topics. And they educate us twice a year. It's part of our responsibility to go to the events. He does allow you to miss events if need be. But for the most part, he prefers us to go to the events twice a year. We will spend 3 days studying IRA topics. And then he gives us an exam. But a little bit of info about his exam. It is totally open book. He is not testing our knowledge. And he pretty much admits it. This is a volunteer program. We are paying to be in it. If we are in it, we want to learn. We're not looking for any type of certification, and we don't get any type of certification through him. We get bragging rights, I guess, to say we're in the Ed Slot program, and that's not how you do this. But outside of that, why does he give us an exam? His thought is this. He wants to make sure we're paying attention and we're gathering important topics and we're reading his book. This guy, Chris, is just so incredibly proud of his manuals that he gives. They're 150, 60, 70 pages. They're huge. And he's very proud of them. And he wants us to read through them. And he admits they're pretty deep reading. But he has plenty of examples and concepts and reviews. And what he does is he gives us 20 questions. He will give us the section of the book where we can go and read and find the answer. I decided to take that and turn it into something a little more challenging and, in my opinion, a little more fun. Since we can take the exam as often as we need until we, quote unquote, pass, which is a score of 70 or higher, and since he gives pretty much the section of the book where we can find the answer, I go through it the first time, Chris, just seeing if I picked up on all the concepts that he taught us. The test covers each learning session. So when I go in another few months to Washington, D.C. and study for 3 days there, my test will cover the topics he taught at that presentation. So I go through first on my own to see how I do, to see if I nail it, see if I get them right. If not, he tells you which questions you got wrong, and you take the exam again. Now, you might get different questions that time. He has a different bed of questions. There's 20 questions total, and I think he has 30, 40, or 50 that randomly get chosen. But I try to go through it the first time to see if I get them right. And then if I don't, then I go back, read the book, and answer them correct the second time, and I'm done with my quote-unquote test. Again, his aim is not to test our abilities. His aim is to make sure we're at least learning what he wants us to learn. So some people in the group hate this part of the membership, that we have to take this exam. It's not hard, Chris. I do it sitting on my couch, usually with the TV on. And you know me, I geek out on learning this stuff. So to me, it's actually fun. I don't consider it a hassle at all. And when I get something wrong, folks, I kind of like it. And you know why? It means I've learned something I didn't know. If I answer the question wrong, it's because I didn't know the answer. And then when I can go back and read, because it gives you the section, so you know, if we had to actually find the answer in a 170-page work manual, then I would be a little perturbed because I don't have that much time. But if he gives me a section of pages, and that's usually what he does, this is available on page 38 to 56. I mean, if he narrows it down and I know the section I have to go to find the answer, I actually enjoy that part because I'll read more and comprehend more. So anyways, I just wanted to give a little background on the exam and what he does and how I'm now sitting here going to be going over it with everybody here. And what I hope, and Chris, you have not seen this test, have you?
I have not. And now that you described how you were able to take the test with the open book and him pointing you to where to go to find the answer, I now find it patently unfair that you're going to give me these questions, having not been through the training program nor received the manual. And I'm just in it cold. So I just want everybody to realize that's the situation before we start this thing.
Well, a couple of things. Chris's position at the firm is he runs the retirement planning part of our firm, folks, and he is the go-to expert on Social Security. I don't expect him to get every single question right on this. He may. I did. And that's not saying much. But I did the sitting and I went through these 20 questions and I got them all. I didn't have to go back and research any. But it doesn't mean a damn thing. That and a cup of nickel, as they say, won't get you a cup of tea in China. So we want people to learn from this. Whether Chris gets it right or wrong is immaterial. All of you are going to be given a chance to guess the answer. And then I'll give the correct answer. And Chris and I will talk a little bit about why that may be. And that's my intent on this. But yes, you are right, Chris. You didn't get to attend the training and you didn't have the manual in front of you. But in defense of me, I did not open the manual. I do it on the second go through on the questions that I got wrong. I was pleasantly surprised when I got all 20 of these correct the first time I sat there. And I'll admit, Chris, some of them, pure luck that I got it right. I could rule out one or two of the answers, but then it just came down to, you know, a coin flip, and I guessed correctly on some of these. Okay, I think that's enough of a lead-in, if you will. One thing you will notice, folks, because this very first question has absolutely nothing to do with IRAs. Ed's program, even though 90-95% is retirement planning, IRAs, and 401k specifically, he does throw some non-IRA topics in place. This is all from the program that he ran last year in the fall. That one last year I did not attend. I was in Ohio, and it was out in Nevada, and I didn't feel like flying all the way out to Vegas. So I stayed in Ohio. And he records everything, and I could watch the presentation later. So I wasn't actually in Nevada. And one of the sections that he did, Chris, just to give a little background on why he asked this question, were year-end tax planning strategies that he felt people should pay attention to. And his first question kind of ties into that. And it goes like this. The $16,000 annual cash gift is taxable to whom? The person who made the gift? Now, he always gives four choices. So I will read the four choices. I'll give you guys a few seconds to ponder it. Chris, you give me your answer, and then I'll say what the answer is to everyone else. So a $16,000 annual cash gift is taxable to whom? The person giving the gift, the person receiving the gift, both the person giving and receiving the gift, neither the person giving or receiving the gift. So who is the $16,000 annual cash gift taxable to? Those are the four answers. Do you want to take a guess? Do you mean to repeat the answers?
No, I think I've got it. As people are thinking about it, are we going to call this the questions A, B, C, and D, or 1, 2, 3, 4? Or?
Let's go 1, 2, 3, 4, since he usually gives 4. So
okay. My vote, now that everybody's had a chance to think about it, is number 4. The $16,000 he's referring to is what's referred to as the annual gift tax exclusion. And nobody is taxed on that gift in that particular case.
Number 4 is correct. Do we have a clap, 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 or ding, 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 ding?
We have clapping. There we go. And I have my buzzer ready for, I'll buzz myself when I get it wrong.
That buzzer is the most annoying buzzer I've ever heard. Anyways, Chris is correct. And a lot of people don't understand that. Most likely people listening to this radio show, this podcast, probably got this correct because you're all do-it-yourselfers. You're totally into finance. You read a lot. You understand a lot. But you'd be surprised the number of people I run into who don't quite understand the gift tax or the gift tax exclusion.
Or they're really worried and thinking they can't possibly gift to someone more than that amount. They put this really, really hard limit on it based on this annual gift tax exclusion because I can tell from their conversations that I have with them that they're worried that their entire world is going to collapse if they give any more than the 16,000.
Absolutely. So a couple of things to keep in mind then. Let's delve a little bit deep into the 16,000. And did they adjust that this year before
they
we
did.
Get too deep
mm-hmm.
into this?
Yeah, it's now 16,000 starting in 2023.
Okay. So that annual 16,000 is how much you can give someone without being subject, or that gift being subject, to potential gift taxes, with the word potential being italicized. The 16,000, and it is correct
well,
in its
let
exam.
Let me correct one thing. It went to 16,000 in 2022. We're recording this in 2023, so it's actually bumped up even further. It's now 17,000 this year. But you must have taken that test kind of before 2023 happened.
Yes, this was our fall of 2022 exam.
Yep. So it's technically in 2023 up to 17,000.
Correct. Though that's what I asked. Did they increase that? So it's now 17. When I took the exam, it was 16. The point is moot what the dollar amount is. Understand what this is, folks. That is a gift tax exclusion amount. You are allowed to give that gift to any number of people. Now, there was a push in Congress not too long ago. It didn't pass to make what is now 17,000, but when I took Ed's test, it was 16,000, to make that an annual gift in totality. Right now, it's per person. So you can gift 16,000 to 10 different people or $160,000, and it won't affect your gift tax at all, and it won't require you to file a gift tax return. Now, again, there was a move, and keep your eye on that because it wouldn't surprise me if someday that happens. The 16 or now 17,000 becomes the total you can give in a year to any number of people. It's not the way it is now, but there is a movement, and I think that movement has a potential, no time soon, but what you might start to see 5, 7, 8 years from now. But right now, you can give $17,000. When I took Slot's exam, it was 16. $17,000 to someone and not have to file a gift tax return. The recipient of a gift never has to pay tax on the gift. Now, if they are given a capital gain, they might have to pay taxes when the item is sold in the future, but that's a topic for another show.
Right.
But the actual giving of a gift does not cause someone to have to pay taxes on the receipt of it. And the person giving the gift doesn't have to file a gift tax return unless it exceeds $17,000 in a year, and a year being measured from January 1st to December 31st in that time period. Now, a couple of things to keep in mind. If you give someone more, let's say you give someone $27,000, does that mean you now have to pay taxes on that extra $10,000? If, again, you're allowed to gift $17,000 a year, but you give someone $27,000, you breached that by $10,000. That does not mean you owe taxes on it, folks. It simply means you have to file a gift tax return when you do your taxes. And everybody has an exemption amount. It's got to be 12 point something million, Chris. Do you happen to have that, or can you Google it?
Yeah, let me pull up, because that's also been adjusted. So let me
it's
give you the
adjusted.
Let me give you the current version of it here.
Well, as Chris tries to Google it, everybody has an exemption amount. It's going to be 12 point something million. That's how much you can give to someone during your life or at death.
It's almost 13 million now. It's 12.92 million now.
Okay, we'll call it 12.9 million. It's a massive amount of money, folks. The gift tax represents wealth you give away during your life. The estate tax represents wealth you give away at death. the two of them are intertwined. They are one in the same. Right. If you give it during life, it's a gift. If you give it at death, it's a bequest. That's all. The only difference is it's semantics. You can give someone $12.9 million of wealth and not have to pay any tax on it. But if you give any one person more than $17,000, and that's in 2023. If you're listening to this in 24 or 25, it's going to be a different number. That number changes every year. Right now, it's 17.
Well, it depends on inflation, just to be clear. It was 15 for actually many years, and then switched to 16 last year and then 17 this year because of the inflation. So it doesn't necessarily change every year, but it could.
It could. So if you give someone more, in my example, $10,000 more, does that mean you have to pay taxes? No. It means on the gift tax return, you're going to list what your current exemption is, $12.9 million. And then it's going to show all the previous gifts you gave in excess of the annual gift tax exclusion amount to any one person. Those get subtracted out of the $12.9 million. So let's say over your life you've given $30,000 away. I don't have my calculator handy. So your $12.9 is going to get reduced by $30,000. And then that $10,000 in my example that you just gave, that will also be subtracted. So your $12.9 million can get smaller and smaller every year, but it's such a big amount. It doesn't really impact most people.
Right. So if you're looking to gift more than 17, don't set that. The only annoyance I point out to people is if you do give more than the annual gift tax exclusion, you've got to file the gift tax return, which is, you know, an extra addendum essentially onto your regular tax filing. But it's not the end of the world. It will, if you have someone who's you're paying to do your taxes, it's likely to cost a little bit more, but it's not a monumental task. So people kind of exaggerate the consequences of gifting more than the annual gift tax exclusion. So if you've been looking for a reason to give somebody in your life more than the annual gift tax exclusion, hopefully now you'll reconsider that because it's really not that big a deal.
Especially when you're only giving, say, dollars, and all what you're doing is reducing your $12.9 million by the taxable amount. That it's not a difficult thing to do. A couple of things to keep in mind, though. A couple of little caveats. Let's go down a rabbit hole a little bit deeper on this. Married couples can combine their gifts. So you could, now that it's $17,000, a married couple could give $34,000 per person. The husband gives one. The wife gives one. One being $17,000 from the husband, $17,000 from the wife. Now a child perhaps could get $34,000. Whereas if the husband gave all $34,000 from his assets, he would have to reduce his $12.9 million by $17,000. Again, the $12.9 million is so huge, reducing it by 17 isn't going to make much of a difference. But politicians muck around with your total lifetime exemption amount. It used to be as low as $600,000. Not that long ago, I have sweaters that I used to wear at a time when the exemption was $600,000. It's not that long ago.
One of those nice Cosby sweaters you used to wear?
Yes, one of those Cadigan Cosby sweaters. So I feel the 12.9 is going to drop back down to $5 million and then be adjusted for inflation for the past 10 years. But it's going to drop back to where it was when the Trump tax cuts first passed. That the increase of the exemption amount, the doubling of it, was only for 10 years. It's going to drop back to where it was in 2017, but they will adjust it for inflation from 2017 to 2026. So people right now think it's going to net out somewhere probably around $7 to $8 million, not the $5 million that it was back then. But that's still a big drop, folks. And there are politicians who want to drop it down even more to $1 million or less. Now $17,000 could make a pretty big difference. So making sure you do split gifts between a husband and wife could be a very good tax planning strategy. The reason Ed was mentioning this to us in the fall was a reminder to tell people, in order for this gift to count when we were doing this in 2022, but now it's 2023, but in order for the gift to count, the gift has to be a completed gift. It has to be impossible for the person who made the gift to pull it back or to call it off. If it's not a completed gift, if it's not totally impossible for that gift to be undone on December 31st, it's not a completed gift for 2022, or in this case now, 2023. What was he getting at? Those of you who might write a check to your child at Christmas time for $17,000 and say, here, honey, here's $17,000 as a 2023 gift. That child has got to cash it by December 31st, or it is not a 2023 gift. Why? You could put a stop payment on the check. It's not a completed gift. Unless you went to a bank and you got a certified check, which automatically debits the money from your checking account immediately, unless it's one of those checks, simply writing a check to a child and saying and putting the date on there, 2023, does not make it a completed gift until it is cashed. And if it doesn't get cashed until the following year, 2024 in this example, it is not a 2023 gift. And so many people, Chris, don't understand that. And they write Christmas gifts and it doesn't get cashed in time to count as a gift for that particular year.
That's a good point to make. Don't want them stacked up accidentally in the next year or something and accidentally exceed it.
Exactly. Alrighty, we beat that gift horse to death. Get it? Gift horse to death. That was a good one. That was a good one. I like that one. All right. That just came to me. It spurred a moment. It shows you the brilliancy of my comedic genius.
Brilliance. I just know I'm one for one so far. I'm at 100%. So I'm feeling good so far.
You're feeling good. Mm-hmm. All right. This one, I don't really like this as a question at all. I'm almost tempted to not even ask it. I think I'm going to skip this one. It has to do with cryptocurrency, and I don't want anything to do with crypto, so I would just feel better.
Okay.
Not even getting into that one. Sorry, folks, there's only going to be 19 questions. All right. The question is, how can an excess contribution to an IRA be fixed? Your four answers are: 1, remove the contribution; 2, recharacterize the contribution; 3, carry the contribution forward to a future year that you would be allowed to make a contribution. Oh, is that was 3, not 4. Mm-hmm. And 4, all of the above.
So I've discovered that if I just answer the fourth answer, I'm going to get them all correct. So I'm going to go with the fourth answer, since now I'll be 2 for 2, at least in my estimation. So
you are 2 for 2. Whenever you see all of the above, it's usually all of the above.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's he getting at, folks, here? When you make an excess contribution to an IRA, it means you either put more money in than you were allowed to put in, or you put money into the IRA and you were never allowed to put money into the IRA. But one way or another, you got money into the IRA that you weren't allowed to put in. So that has to be fixed. Mm-hmm. We talked about this many a times on the show, Chris. The government gives you a pretty good amount of time to fix it. Mm-hmm. You have until October 15th of the year after the excess contribution to fix it. If you make the excess contribution in January of 2023, you have to October 15th of 2024. Goodness, that's plenty. Well, I don't want to say plenty. Some people wait and still don't fix it, but it gives you all of 2023 and nearly all of 2024 to fix it. Mm-hmm. And you fix it one of three ways. You remove the excess contribution. Now, we talked about this before. Do not simply, if you put money into the IRA and you realize later you shouldn't have done it or you weren't eligible to do it. Let's say you put $7,000 in and you weren't allowed to put anything in. Either you had no earned income or you had too much earned income and you were, say, funding a Roth IRA that has earnings limits. You earned too much and you couldn't put anything into a Roth IRA and you put $7,000 in. Or you put $7,000 into a traditional IRA, but you didn't have any earned income, so you were never allowed to put it in to begin with. If you have excess money in the IRA, and all what you do is you call up the custodian and say, hey, take out $7,000, please send it to me. That does not technically fix an excess contribution. You have to tell the custodian you want to make a corrective distribution. So it gets coded correctly. So it doesn't get coded as just a normal distribution. It's a corrective distribution. It's just one of those little nuances that people don't quite understand. So again, the first choice was remove the contribution. That is correct. But Chris, you can also recharacterize a contribution. Why don't you explain what that means?
That's where you kind of reclassify the contribution as something that you are allowed to make. Say, oops, I can't do purple, but I can do blue, kind of a situation. So maybe you contributed to a Roth and you weren't able to. You could recharacterize that contribution as a regular traditional IRA contribution, which has no income limits. Now, the deductibility of said contribution has income limits, but the act of making a contribution in and of itself, there are no income limits. So if the reason you were, you know, later disallowed from making that contribution is you ended up making too much money, so you could not make the Roth contribution, you can reclassify, or it's called recharacterize, that contribution to something you were allowed to make. And I probably hear through the podcast, my headphones, later on people yelling, wait a minute, you can't recharacterize anymore. That is untrue. You cannot recharacterize a Roth conversion, but you can absolutely recharacterize contributions. So be clear on that. And that's essentially what's going on there. You're just reclassifying it as a contribution you are allowed to make. And then the IRS says, okay, we're fine with that.
Exactly. And the final item was you can carry the contribution forward to a future year. This one could get a little bit confusing, but if you stop and think about it, it totally makes sense. Let's just say somebody put in 2023 $7,000 into a Roth IRA, only to find out their earnings were so high they weren't eligible to put money into a Roth IRA. We see that a lot. It's a very common issue that people run into. So that person in 2023 can take it out, or they can sit there and say, well, wait a minute. I have to undo this by October 15th of 2024. In 2024, my earnings are going to be well under, or even slightly under, just under the annual earnings limits for contributing to a Roth. In other words, I will be able to contribute to a Roth next year. And there's no doubt in that person's mind, say, maybe it was a bonus, a one-time bonus that pushed them over the limits. Maybe it was a big commission they got if they're a commission-based salesman. That's not going to repeat itself. And there's no doubt or little doubt in their mind that in 2024, they will be able to contribute to a Roth. Well, they can leave that money in the Roth. They don't have to take it out. They have till October 15th of the following year, October 15th of 2024, to take it out. Come January 1st of 2024, it's a brand new year. Mm-hmm. And they can say, hey, that excess that I put in 2023, I'm not going to take it out only to put it back in for 2024. I'm going to reduce that excess amount by my annual contribution limit. And in my example, they're just going to wash each other out because in 2024, the limit, let's just assume, is still going to be $7,000 and the two wash each other out. So you can do that. And if you put in more, if you put in $14,000, you could still leave the 14 in. And in October of 24, before October 15th, to avoid the 6% penalty tax, if you were allowed to make a contribution in 2024, you don't need to remove all 14, only to then go back and put 7 in. You can say, hey, I'm only going to take out 7. The remaining 7 is being offset by my 2024 contribution. So you can carry the contribution forward as many years as you want. However, any year that excess stays in there, not after you offset it, if there's still dollars remaining that have to be offset with future years' limits, you have to pay a 6% penalty on that excess amount every year that it stays in the Roth IRA. So it may not be worth leaving it in, but you theoretically, if you wanted to, put $100,000 into your Roth and slowly offset it every year as long as you're willing to pay a 6% penalty. If you have a particular investment that might be nailing it and paying a 6% penalty every year is no big deal, it's something that theoretically, we're not saying to go out and do it, but theoretically, it can work that way. But the IRS and the government who writes the laws, the IRS only interprets them, says you can offset excess contributions with future contributions that you are allowed to make. But every year that you leave it in, you got to pay a 6% penalty tax. And we've spoken about this before. We don't have to get into it, but Natalie Choate's little strategy, again, she says no one should try this, but theoretically, and she has a very good point on that as well that we spoke about. But that's excess contributions. Anything you want to add on that?
Just tidy up one thing, just to remind everybody that for 2023, the IRA contribution limits are $6,500 for those under age 50, 50 and older, with the catch-up contribution are able to do $7,500. So just giving you the latest info, since there's been a change to those this year.
Yeah. Ever since the dawn of something called Google, yours truly has refused to study.
To memorize limits. The new limits. Yeah,
right. Exactly. I never do anymore. Yeah. There was a time we had to.
Yeah.
But now with Google, I can look it up in split seconds. Why waste my precious brain space on remembering those numbers? Mm-hmm. Okay. This one's straightforward. You got two choices, true?
Oh, or false? Even better.
Pretty straightforward. Okay. True or false? A qualified charitable distribution, or QCD for short, will fail if anything of value is given back to the IRA owner by the charity. True or false?
That is, in fact, true.
And he is correct, folks. Hopefully everybody got that right. I don't know if you're clapping all the time, but I think you're 3 for 3.
Yeah, I forgot to clap on my last right
forgot
answer.
To clap. Yeah. Forgot to clap. And we skipped the crypto question. So Chris is nailing it, 3 for 3. A QCD, a qualified charitable distribution, folks, that's available to IRA owners who are over the age of 70 and a half. Mm-hmm. Not in the year they turn 70 and a half. They actually have to physically pass 181 days into the year, they turn 70 and a half. They got to pass age 70 and a half. Once they get past 70 and a half, they can give up to $100,000 a year from their IRA directly to a charity and not have to declare that money as income. Mm-hmm. Once required minimum distributions begin at age 73, and for some of us at age 75, once required minimum distributions begin, a QCD could be used to offset required minimum distributions. It could, for some people, turn out to be a very compelling tax planning strategy for those people who may not quite need their RMDs, or people who may have breached the IRMA limits because of their RMDs, maybe by a few $1,000s. If they are charitably inclined, they could give some of that RMD if done correctly, which we won't get into on this show, but if done correctly, they could give some of the RMD to a charity via a QCD, keep their income because they never have to declare it as income, keep that income below perhaps an IRMA limit, which is a cliff, and $1 over the limit could push you into a IRMA bracket, causing you to have to pay thousands of dollars per person, per couple, if they're on Medicare. So doing a QCD could be a very wise choice. The key, do not receive anything of value.
Right.
The IRS in or Congress did say excluding items of nominal value. They didn't define that. And I would not want to get into a shouting match with the IRS on what nominal value means. Is it a $100 gift? Is it a dollar gift? Is it a little bumper sticker that said I gave? I would highly recommend, and Ed Slott strongly agrees, don't receive anything, even the bumper sticker that says, I gave. Just don't receive anything if it was a QCD. Just be on the safe side. But if you receive something of value, your QCD will be disallowed, and it will be taxable to you. And if you've already filed your tax return, you'll have to go back and file an amended return. So just don't receive anything of value to disqualify your QCD. Okay, that was a fairly straight one.
Yeah.
Alrighty. This one gets a little trickier. Mm. So will you be 4 for 4? Jade dies at age 55 in 2022. Okay. Her beneficiary is her older sister, Meg, who is age 60. What options are available to Meg for her RMDs from the IRA that she just inherited from Jane? Okay, Meg's options. Only distribution over Meg's single life expectancy. Only distributions over Jane's single life expectancy. Only the 10-year rule. And number 4, either distributions over Meg's single life expectancy or the 10-year rule. I told you this one's a little bit more tricky. Do you need me to repeat the 4
No,
items?
But maybe for our listeners, do that one. Give them the answers one more time.
Okay, all 4 of them again? Okay. Number 1, so remember, folks, Jane is 55 and she dies in 2022. Her 60-year-old sister inherits her IRA. Sister's name is Meg. Meg can take distributions only over her single life expectancy, or Meg can take distributions over Jane's single life expectancy, or Meg is locked into the 10-year payout, or Meg has a choice. She can take distributions over her single life expectancy or the 10-year payout.
So once again, answer number four, you've made the correct answer. So maybe you should mix it up on the future ones. But I believe pretty confidently that number four is the answer. And the key here is the ages.
Why don't you explain which? Well, clap, 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 clap.
Chris, well, you don't have to do that. I actually have the sound bite here. You don't have to do it. Yeah, so the 10-year rule, you know, that's, you know, after the SECURE Act, there's this 10-year rule option that is now meant at the time to kind of replace, in a lot of cases, the old stretch where you could stretch it out over the beneficiary's life expectancy. A lot of beneficiaries now have to play by that rule, the 10-year rule, and Meg still has that option. She could elect to play by the 10-year rule. And because RMDs hadn't started yet for Jane, Meg essentially has that 10-year period to do as she pleases for distributions and take that money out as long as it's all gone by the year number 10. The other option, though, is she still qualifies for what we used to call the stretch. And I guess we could still call it the stretch, in that she's able to take distributions over her life expectancy, although she'll have to start those distributions the year following the decedent's death. She can't wait, and, you know, she doesn't have as much flexibility in the early years as the 10-year rule, but she is allowed to stretch it out over a much longer period of time because she's not more than 10 years younger than Jane. Not only is she not younger than Jane, she's older than Jane when Jane died. So Meg actually retains the ability, if she elects to do so and follows the rules, to stretch over her single life table kind of as before, kind of pre-secure, if you will.
Correct. So the exemption that Meg got is she is not more than 10 years younger than the person she inherited the IRA from,
right,
which we've often said it's kind of designed for siblings in this example. So Meg becomes an eligible designated beneficiary or a human who's eligible to stretch. But because Jane died before her required beginning date, Meg can actually choose if she wants the 10-year rule or if she wants the stretch. So that was, I mean, we don't know which one Meg's going to choose. This is just a hypothetical question. But Meg could have chosen the 10-year rule. And if she chose the 10-year rule, there would be no distributions for the first 9 years because Jane died before her required beginning date. In other words, Jane died before April 1st of the year following the year Jane would have turned 73. And because she died before then, Jane, if she took the 10-year rule, does not have to take any required minimum distributions during the first 9 years. And then in year 10, she would have to close the entire IRA. Or because she is not more than 10 years younger than the IRA decedent, the owner of the IRA who died, there's only a 5-year age difference, so she's not more than 10 years younger, she can stretch as well. And if she chose to stretch, she would stretch over her single life expectancy, but she would have to begin those payouts by December 31st of 2023. Remember, in the example, Jane died in 2022. So she would have to start those distributions by December 31st of this year. She would start to take required minimum distributions based on her single life expectancy. We're not going to dive deep into how that calculation is actually done. It's not what we're trying to do on this show, but we're just trying to get you to know Meg is essentially an eligible designated beneficiary. So she has a few choices two choices that she could adopt when it comes to what type of required minimum distributions does she want to take from this inherited account. Okay.
Perfect.
Do we have time to keep going? You are 4 for 4. Are you 4 for 5?
It's up to you. We could, as long as we have one that's not a super long one that you're going to go down 12 rabbit holes, we can do one more.
No, we can do a couple of these. All right. When a person makes a non-deductible contribution to their traditional IRA, what form does the IRS require be filed to claim that non-deductible contribution as after-tax basis? Form 8606 is number one. Form 5329 is number two. Tax Form 1040 is number three. And Form 5498 is number four.
Well, I probably would have known this until you suggested all those different forms.
Well, that's the whole point.
I know. This is another one where I don't commit that hard to my memory cells because I can look it up in an instant when I need to. It is, in fact, one of those three forms. I will confirm that. And since every other time the fourth answer has been correct, I'm going to stick with that. And that was where I was kind of leaning anyway. That was my gut. My initial reaction was 5498. So I'm going to go with 5498.
Okay, that's what Chris went with, folks. You all shout out your answers. And then, Chris, take the clap one and don't play it.
Oh.
Play the buzz one.
Okay. Well, it's about time, I guess. Is it 5329?
Negative.
Yeah, so it's 8606.
8606. Oh, let's start from the bottom and work the way up, folks. Form 5498 is not even a form you file. It is a form your IRA custodian is required to file by May 31st, declaring to the IRS the value of your IRA. You usually get a copy of that towards late May, and it's just the value of your IRA that the custodian is reporting to the IRS. Okay, that's Form 5498. 1040, that's your tax form. I don't even think it's called 1040 anymore, right? Didn't they get rid of it and they just replaced it with a bunch of other little things? This is really a Bob question, but I was always in the impression 1040 as we knew it years ago does not quite exist anymore. Form 5329, that's the mea culpa. I screwed up. I need to pay a penalty form. When you do something wrong with your IRA, that is going to result in a penalty tax. You file Form 5329. It is Form 8606 that you file every year to track basis.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
In non-deducted basis that you may have put into your IRA. So that is Form 8606. Okay. This one you might not get either, but if you think it through, I think you can do it.
Okay.
I think you can do it. If a trust that was named as beneficiary of an IRA fails the IRS see-through test, what distribution rule will apply if the IRA owner dies before their required beginning date? Number one, the 5-year rule. Number two, the 10-year rule. Number three, the ghost life expectancy rule. And these are all legitimate rules, folks. None of those three were made up. The fourth one, the lump sum rule.
Okay, I'll let people ponder that for a moment. I know I've got a strong feeling on one of the four.
I'm going to say you can do this one. So get ready to hit the clap, but don't take your other hand.
I'm going to be ready.
Don't take your other hand off the buzzer, though.
Okay.
Okay, so the 5-year rule, the 10-year rule, the ghost life expectancy rule, or the lump sum rule. What rule applies? If someone dies and that person named a trust as beneficiary, but later the IRS deems the trust did not pass the see-through test, and the person who died died before their required beginning date.
That, in my opinion, is going to fall into the 5-year rule for distribution of that IRA.
Okay. Ding, 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 ding. You did it. Yeah.
That one, the way I always remember that is once it falls on being a non-human, you're pretty much dealing with 5-year rule. And then there's exceptions where a non-human like a trust can be treated like a human, but it has to follow these very strict rules. And so when it fails one of the rules, like the see-through test, that puts back into that non-human status. And 5-year rule reigns supreme at that point is kind of in my brain how I remember that.
Chris is 100% correct. The 5-year rule will apply in this case. So first of all, number 4, the lump sum rule. There ain't no such rule as the lump sum rule. They just kind of threw that in to trick us. So what you have here is two things, and Chris is correct. In order for a trust to be a eligible, well, not even want to say eligible, but in order for a trust to qualify to be beneficiary of an IRA, that trust must pass the series of rules, which again gets beyond the scope of the show. And if it passes all the rules, it's deemed a quote unquote see-through trust. So essentially, Ed was saying in this question, the trust didn't pass all the rules, so it was not eligible to be a beneficiary. So essentially, you have no human beneficiary, because what happens when the named beneficiary is either dead, you know, they predeceased the IRA owner, or they don't qualify to be beneficiary of an IRA, such as a trust that does not qualify as a see-through trust, essentially, the beneficiary becomes the estate. Now, we could go really down a rabbit hole and say you would first go to the custodial agreement of the IRA and see if there was no name or eligible beneficiary, who would go next, because the trustee of that trust would disclaim and someone else would go next. And you have to look at the custodial agreement. I'm getting way too deep in, so let's not go down that. But theoretically, there are a few steps a competent advisor would go through before making the 5-year rule apply. But let's just assume, Chris, none of those steps would apply here. So you have a trust that does not qualify. You essentially have an IRA with no human beneficiary. The other key that Chris picked up on, at least I think he did, as he solidified his answer, was the IRA owner died before their required beginning date. Mm-hmm. If the IRA owner dies, and the required beginning date now, because RMDs are not applicable to people under 73, so the required beginning date right now, at least for the next 10 years, or till the time they pass Secure 3 and change the rule again, is April 1st of the year following the year you turn 73. So clearly this person died in this example before then. When the IRA owner dies before then, and there is no human beneficiary, and the custodial document does not come to anyone's rescue, then the 5-year rule applies. However, the remaining two rules are actually real rules. The 10-year rule, which would not apply in this particular situation because the decedent died before the required beginning date. But the ghost life expectancy rule is a real rule that would have applied here if the IRA owner died after their required beginning date. When there is no human beneficiary, What then happens is the estate will most likely become the de facto beneficiary. And you theoretically, I don't know if the estate would want to keep the IRA open, but the ghost life expectancy rule steps in. And that is when the estate must begin required minimum distributions based on the remaining life expectancy of the dead guy. Mm-hmm. So they call it the ghost life expectancy because it could be for as much as 13 years if they died right away at 73 now. And then it gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. Most likely, Chris, the estate is just going to say close it and distribute the IRA. Mm-hmm. But there might be a reason why the estate would want to keep it open and try to slow down the distribution of that IRA as long as possible. And they're allowed to do that with the ghost life expectancy rule. But that ghost rule is only available when the IRA owner died after their required beginning date, not before, and there is no human beneficiary.
Right.
That's when you use the ghost life expectancy rule. So the three rules, the first three rules were real rules. The fourth rule was made up. And Chris, you kind of deduced that yourself. So I had a feeling you were going to get that one.
Yeah, so I'm 4 out of 5. So 80%, I've got a B minus, I guess, at this point. Hopefully in the future show, as we continue through all 19 of these, I'll redeem myself and get my average up a little bit higher. But I feel pretty good not having gone through any of the training recently on this and just kind of relying on what's stuck in my brain. I'm kind of kicking myself over the IRS on the tax form.
I thought you were going to get the 8606.
I know, and I should have. I should have. It's just,
it's not like we don't talk about it on this show.
I know. Yep, I fumbled that one, that is for sure. But
I would have threw you under the bus on the one you just answered, not the 8606 one. So, But I'm sure you see that with your students. You sometimes see a brilliant student and you're like, how the heck did they get that one wrong, but they got this one right?
Right, yeah, true. Yep, human nature, so.
Okay.
Well, thanks, everybody. This is what we got, at least another show of this. We'll have a Q&A show in between, but hopefully you're finding these as entertaining as I am. I kind of like them. So looking forward to doing some more of these.
We got 12 more questions. We got 12 more to go through.
Okay. So glad you made it back safely to Colorado. I know you won't be as sweaty when you go on your walks, at least for a while.
Well, I've been joking. It's kind of a term I made up. I started jogging and running, which for me, folks, I severed my ACL 28 years ago when I was a police officer, and I've never ran since. Literally, I have never jogged since. That's why I took up hiking. And Florida is so damn flat, Chris, I wasn't getting enough of cardio. So I started jogging, running. I'm telling you, after 28 years of never jogging, I felt like a fish out of water trying to jog again. I just felt weird. It took forever to kind of get going again. And muscles that I totally forgot I even had were unbelievably sore. It was quite a learning experience. So I call it J-O-L-K-I-N-G, jolking, half jog, half walk. So I have no idea if that's a term or not, but it's what I said I was doing. And it worked out good. It definitely helped me get a better workout. But it also got me realizing that, my goodness, going 28 years without jogging, you certainly feel it when you try to jog again. I don't know what you do for physical activity, but if you haven't jogged in a while, you'll feel it when you start jogging.
Yeah, lately I'm mostly lifting up heavy bulldogs to take them outside and bring them back inside and chase them around the yard and stuff like that. We're fostering a very misbehaved English bulldog right now.
Oh, who, okay.
I may have mentioned him on the podcast. I guess I can give everybody an update. He's got 4 separate heart defects, and we actually just heard from CSU that they are going to try to repair him, and he's such a unique case that they are going to to their credit, pick up the majority of the tab, because it's going to be a very expensive and extensive surgery with a lot of specialized techniques, apparently, and a lot of high-end folks in on this repair. So we're hoping they're going to, isn't scheduled yet, but young Sheldon is destined for the operating table, and hopefully he'll get all fixed up and live a long and prosperous life instead of the trajectory he's on now, which he's started to exhibit some signs of congestive heart failure at 6 months old. So he's...
Isn't that the name of a sitcom on CBS, Young Sheldon?
Yeah, but he's young. Okay. He's 6 months and his name is Sheldon. So,
Did you name him after that?
No, he came with that name. I don't really use that name anymore. I call him Fatness. Because he is a chunk. They're just built different. It is the heaviest. It's like picking up a wet bag of sand. And the French bulldog we have is a little bit like that. I mean, compared to other dogs, they feel like that. This is like, I guess, a really big wet bag of sand. So I think I mentioned Sheldon on a previous show, but if not,
you have.
But that's what's going on. So I'll keep everybody up to date on Sheldon, and hopefully this month here in March, they're trying to get him on the table to fix him up, and we'll hope that it actually works. They're extraordinarily talented there at the vet hospital at Colorado State University, one of the best vet hospitals in the world. So if anybody can fix them, it's likely them. And I'm happy that they decided to move forward, because otherwise he was not probably going to make it through his first year of life.
Well, I wish young Sheldon all the best. Keep us posted on the podcast, and hopefully you'll not have to keep lifting young Sheldon up all the time.
Yeah, he's not really excited about going outside, especially when it's icy and stuff. So I have to carry him out there. Plus, he's not trustworthy, and he might run off somewhere. So I carry him out to his little pen, and he's a load. So I have to lift with my legs. If I bend over, I'm going to strain my back. It's one of those kind of deals. So, thanks everybody for listening, and we'll continue with these quiz questions next week. Stay tuned for the Q&A show later this week, and I'll talk to you soon, Jim.
Okay.
Everybody,
I'll talk
take
to you
care.
Guys later. Okay. Everybody, okay. Have a great day. Bye.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.